Our readings today are a presentation bracketed by the beautiful earth tones of the Native American flute. Words courtesy of David Mayware, music courtesy of David McDonald.
Thank you. Wesley asked me to develop a piece that ministers to the pain and fear of people struggling just to get involved. I reached into my past to seek out a dark moment when my own commitment to systemic change and social justice was deeply challenged. I have to tell you that these stories carry graphic images and use graphic words. Come with me now into the past, to a piece that was written by Maggie Anderson, taken from the introduction to a gathering of poets, which chronicled a four-day readout in 1990, marking the 20th anniversary of May 4th, 1970, when, in their words now, 2,000 to 3,000 people gathered on the commons of Kent State University, where National Guard units had been called on May 2nd to help control student anti-war demonstrations. Shortly after noon on May 4th, 1970, on a grassy knoll beyond Taylor Hall and Prentice Hall parking lot, a contingent of Ohio National Guardsmen opened fire for a period of 13 seconds, striking 13 Kent State University students. Four were killed, one was permanently paralyzed, and the others were wounded in varying degrees of severity. Allison Krauss, Jeffrey Miller, Sandra Shore, and William Schroeder were killed. Within hours, the shock waves were felt throughout the country and around the world. The announcement on the evening news was accompanied by what would become the signifying photograph, a young woman kneeling over the bleeding body of Jeffrey Miller. Student demonstrations and memorial services were held at universities all across the country in the next few days. Army and National Guard units were called into Washington as huge crowds gathered for an anti-war demonstration on Saturday, May 9th. On Sunday, May 10th, Max Frankel wrote in the New York Times, "America was a nation in anguish last week, her population divided, her campuses closed, her capital confused, her president perplexed. The lines of conflict ran zigzag across the land." 10 days after the shooting in Kent State on May 14, 1970, two students were killed, 11 wounded when police shot into Alexander Hall, a woman's dormitory on the campus of Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi. Two black men were found dead after the firing stopped, Philip L. Gibbs, James Earl Green. The State College Board dismissed classes at Jackson State for the remainder of the semester and canceled graduation ceremonies. By the end of May, over 200 colleges and universities had closed, and students went on strike at over 400 others. The nation was facing the grim prospect that differences of opinion about the war in Southeast Asia led us to killing our students in their schools. From that collection, gathering of poets comes the voice of Yvonne Moore Hardenbrook. It's her history lesson. Talking about them killings at Kent State puts me in mind of Chicago's South Side in 37, when we was picketing Republic Steel. We marched peaceable for union rights, not a commie amongst us. Out of nowhere came this solid wall of cops charging us, yelling, "You red bastard, you got no rights." They started in shooting and we turned tail. Point blank they volleyed, them brave back shooting cops. The streets run red. We carried the wounded to Sam's Bar and seven men cashed in on the sawdust floor. I seen the newsreel naming a massacre, but the Trib never run a line. We had to hustle in them days. I was a 42-cent nobody when I joined the union. I didn't wear no button. A button was a sure way to get you fired. Don't see how a boy today starting at 3:35 with everything laid out in front of him can understand how it was when a man was nothing but a cipher. It was the big boys that called the shots. The strike was broke, but the Wagner Act came along and saved the union. We never made a buck until the contracts for armaments to Europe rolled in. Arsenal of democracy, the big boys said we was. And the war in Europe fed our families good. Solidarity forever, prosperity for all. Republic shop went closed. The union made us strong. The big boys made millions selling steel. The government chipped in. They called the shots. Then it was us in World War II shipping our sons overseas along with steel. Prosperity, all right. Ration stamps for meat and sugar, shoes, gasoline, and telegrams for Gold Star mothers. 33 years later, them kids at Kent State was shot for marching peaceable, for picketing to protest our troops in Vietnam. Didn't their folks never tell them, you can't win against the big boys. It's war that sells steel. And the big boys would call the goddamn shots. This last piece was written August 7, 2011, as I breathed the notion of Barack Obama's reelection. If there ever was a time to revolt, to stand up, say yes to life, love, and reason, ain't that time now? If ever there was a chance to make a difference, change the tide, reroute the hard wires, ain't that chance now? If ever the weather blew more frightening change from hate, blown winds from mean spirits, frothing black hole energy from ill will driven anarchy. Ain't that storm a coming? So I say, heed the doors open wide. Welcome the sisters and brothers. Light the path of love. Freshen the inner air by our sheer mass. Can't we see the possibilities? Well, this graying, peace-loving hippie is leaning hard. Hard on the rudder of hope.
Ultimately, this sermon will focus on why social justice is a spiritual matter. I look into that question because in the years I've been here, it feels like that issue has caused pain in our church home. But to begin with, I must borrow from the Carl Sagan quote that you find at the beginning of your order of worship. If you want to explain why social justice is a spiritual matter, you must first invent spiritual matter. My take on spiritual matter involves some metaphors from math and physics. I don't do this out of any disrespect for a belief in God, but if the case can be made without an appeal to God, that would exclude fewer people. I don't want to say that the math and physics are boring, because I love them. And don't let anybody tell you that I don't know how to have a good time. But I've never been able to express the math and physics in a way that is consistent with the wonder of the meaning I am trying to draw from them. So with this sermon, I decided to try a new tack. I first considered the possibility of giving a quiz in Fellowship Hall after the sermon over the math and physics. We'd see if that would make the math and physics more interesting. I got talked out of that. Then I decided that I would try to keep the math and physics to a minimum. Some of it is still there, and I still haven't figured out how to express it in a satisfying way. But here it goes. It starts with the astonishing fact that anything exists at all. My mother and I were talking about this some years ago, and she expressed the same wonder. Doesn't it make sense that there should be nothing? If I let myself sit for even a few moments with this thought of all existence and contrast it with nothingness, I cannot help but be moved. If I sit with it a little longer, it is not just the existence of everything that moves me. The existence of anything, any one thing, gives me chills. Some of those things the machinations of the universe made are rocks and comets, planets and stars. All out of atoms, protons, neutrons, electrons. You too, are among the things made of those protons, neutrons, and electrons. They've been around for billions of years, and right now could very easily be a bump on an asteroid drifting through space. But these atoms brought into existence something alive. More than that, these atoms think and feel and decide and deliberate. Bringing myself face to face with these existences and knowing that they are me never fails to fill me with a sense of awe. The hair on the back of my neck stands up, my breath gets short, and the corners of my eyes start to tremble. I have followed that trembling feeling through the mathematics of identity, through the thought experiments on volition and cause and effect, through the physical laws of conservation of information and metaphors drawn from the conservation of momentum and admittedly very tenuous grasp on a tiny piece of a theory of mass. And I believe I can make a good argument for the existence of the self, soul, personality, identity, agency. All those concepts have more commonalities than differences, in my opinion. And I can also make a case for what I call social solids. I like the term social solids. It makes me sound very clever, I think. Okay, that's nice. I can make an interesting argument, if your standard for interesting is not that high. And it was nice. I got and still get a lot of pleasure out of these contemplations. But ultimately, the point is not about the intellectual gymnastics of the arguments. And believe me, I'm aching to show them off because these arguments are so cool. And they make me look so smart, you know, in my opinion. But the point is that the existence of thought, feeling, and deliberation are spiritual matter. These ideas came up in a class I had with Brad Price, one of my psychology professors at the Methodist Theological School in Ohio. I was explaining the math and physics metaphors I'm suggesting are so meaningful. The professor was pushing me to give the strongest account of these ideas. This conversation took place shortly after the sex abuse scandal at Penn State became known. Brad asked, "What good is this theory to the boy who was molested?" The class was getting pretty antsy, and I knew it would take me a couple of minutes just to change gears to start to answer the question. So I suggested that we move on at that time. But I can actually answer this question in a single word. Billiards. That may sound like it is flirting with the flippant, but let me explain. The cue strikes the cue ball. The cue ball rolls across the table toward the object ball. When they collide, both balls move in different directions. The cue ball does not continue in the same direction in which it was rolling when it was struck by the cue. The existence of the object ball forces the cue ball to go in a different direction. The boy who was molested has a very different experience than that of the cue ball, the object ball. The boy should have every reason to expect that the simple fact of his existence means that when he says no, the direction of the predator will change. But the predator's direction does not change. The boy sees the matter of the universe colliding with what he thought was his self, soul, personhood. How can he explain the fact that the predator's direction is unchanged? He has this most powerful evidence that his self or soul cannot affect the world around him. "I thought I was something," he might be thinking to himself, "but it looks like I am nothing." In physics, a collision between two objects that changes existence into non-existence is called annihilation. If the contemplation of existence inspires awe, then the contemplation of annihilation inflicts a feeling of awe's spiritual opposite. I'm not sure what the word for that is. Desolation, maybe. At the level of simple existence, these collisions may seem so utterly contained within themselves that they seem strictly personal. But this at least is true. Many, perhaps most, of these collisions have an extension into the wider world. The story has often been told from this very pulpit of the fact that the first time anybody was ever held accountable for child abuse, the perpetrator had to be prosecuted under animal cruelty laws. We now take it for granted that the victim of child abuse is supposed to get support. But that support was, and to a great extent remains, the object of social justice efforts. Thomas Eagleton, a United States senator, and George McGovern's first choice as a vice presidential running mate in 1972, was hounded out of public life when it was discovered that he had been treated for depression. His very personal battle for his soul should never have had to include fighting the social injustice of the stigma attached to mental health treatment. Domestic violence used to be the privilege of husbands. When the public called domestic violence a private matter, they participated in the annihilating act by creating still more evidence that the world around them will not treat the victim as if he or she did not exist. The metaphor is suggestive of spiritual matter and annihilation can be extended to a social or population-wide scale. The Korean culture has a concept called Han that may help bring this idea home. Han may be thought of as a collective feeling of isolation in the face of overwhelming odds. It includes a deep lamentation for injustice not brought to account. What comes to mind for me as a paradigm example is South African apartheid. There are plenty of homegrown examples. Recently, the voter suppression targeting African Americans, among many others. It probably would have been more appropriate during Black History Month to focus on a story from the African American present. But my feelings about those stories are still too strong, and I lose the ability to think straight if I try to use them as an example. South African apartheid is sufficiently distant and sufficiently well known that it's, and its distance in time and space, well, space anyway, the full effects of that desolation are not going to go away completely anytime soon. Still, it may be distant enough that I can deal with it, if only well enough, to make a point. The people and laws of South Africa inflicted apartheid with great energy. They erased the distinction between the individual and the population to which they belong. That hate was a constant presence. A public policy of hate-based poverty was the foundation of home, of every home, if one even had a home. And that would be true for both rich and poor, was still the foundation. South African men and women had to raise children in the sweltering inferno of that hate-based poverty. Desolation on a nationwide scale. As this truth passes through every dimension of human life, injustice becomes a social solid, a social phenomenon with a real existence which participates in cause and effect and is more than the sum of personal injustices happening over and over again. The social solids of apartheid were a juggernaut, causing annihilation of every spiritual existence with which it collided. But there's even more to it than that. It starts with the next question, the obvious question. What can we do with this theory, quest, thing? If you've had nothing better to do than keep track of the sermons I've given over the last few summers, then I'm very flattered, but you're probably a stalker. What other explanation could there be for keeping track of something like that? On the plus side, you may have noticed that the idea of community as a precursor to social justice action has emerged as a theme. So I think the next step in this quest thing begins with a story from the history of mathematics. Sorry. It is said that René Descartes could prove the Pythagorean theorem in his head, not just work the formula, but go through the lines of logic proving that it works. Most of us, if we could do this at all, would need pencil and paper. We can't make the symbols in the formula hold still in our mind's eye while simultaneously working the next step. Work that could conceivably be done by the brain is in fact being done by the pencil and paper. Pencil and paper act like extra brain that can be brought to bear on a difficult problem. Conversations with people who care work the same way. When we have a difficult problem, if we try to work it out in our heads, the pieces of the problem won't hold still long enough for us to clearly see what the next step is. But I have noticed that when I talk over a problem with people who care, the same words, the same thoughts behave differently. And I bet I'm not the only one. I imagine that all of us have had the experience of thinking a thought in our head and pushing it and prodding at it and being unable to make it make sense. But speaking the same thought or the same feeling out loud to another person changes everything. The thoughts seem to clarify themselves as they take to the air. The words feel different, and there is some instantaneous resonance that lets you know you've got it. The next steps can be conceived. Pencil and paper can act like extra brain for complex math problems. Conversations with people who care act like extra soul for complex spiritual matters. Whether we are availing ourselves of extra soul or providing extra soul, I believe that we can think of the creation of extra soul for each other as ministry. And through this kind of ministry, whichever side of the conversation we are on, we fulfill ourselves and participate in the fulfillment of others. We build the spiritual matter that we are. Let me suggest that it is building relationships that demystifies these ideas from concepts of math and physics, spirituality and injustice, and makes them something one can act on. The work of personal injustice and social injustice are much more closely related than they sometimes seem. It is easy to look at the call for social justice action and the prominent role it plays in Unitarian Universalism and worry that work on personal injustice is seen as just a stepping stone to work on social injustice. There is a risk of coming to the conclusion that work on personal injustice and social injustice are in conflict. I have come to think of the relationship between personal injustice and social injustice in terms of the yin-yang, which you can find on the front cover of your order of worship. The symbol is designed to demonstrate an important truth about reality. When two things seem in opposition, they are often meant to be together in a complementary way. Light and dark, night and day, activity and rest, self and other, are examples. The meaning of this is deepened by the fact that each carries a piece of the other within it. Work on social injustice carries with it a piece of the personal. It is the feelings of the individual that the atoms of the universe have made possible. It is the pain of the individual that points to the existence of injustice. May I dare to suggest that work on social injustice is incomplete if it is not, at its core, ministry. Ministry to the oppressed, yes. Ministry to the world, yes. But I want to bring particular attention to the idea of ministry to each other. Work on personal injustice carries with it a piece of the universal. The pain any one person feels almost certainly has been, is being, will be felt by many others. Because personal injustice carries a piece of the universal, relief from personal injustice is incomplete until it includes an attachment to the suffering of others, an attachment that makes the world a little bigger, without which the world is a little colder. Consequently, it should come as no surprise that the work of this congregation, whatever form it may take, may ultimately be seen as ministry. We here, we band of brothers and sisters, minister to each other through the creation of extra soul for each other. Extra soul for the one who has labored 1,000 hours to get a 10-minute meeting with an elected official. Extra soul for the one who has labored 1,000 hours to come face to face with the memory of the moment of annihilation. We are here, each of us here on our own journeys, each of us here for our own reasons, and that is as it should be. But each of our journeys brought us here today, in this place, together. The relationships that are the bricks and mortar of beloved community are assembled step by step. The purpose of justice work, be it personal or social, is to take a sad song and make it better. The thought that justice work requires both personal and universal to form a whole circle put me in mind of a story I have told before. Again, that's for you, those of you who are keeping track of these things. I was talking to a friend about social justice. She told me about her work with children. The children have their own social justice issues in their own society. What game to play, what movie to watch, when to break for a snack, what to do with the trash, how to decide. My friend looks at these as teachable moments, opportunities to live and teach UU principles of respect, responsibility, care, and the right to democratic process. She applies herself to helping children grow into people who interact with others and the world in thoughtful and just ways. She considers that her contribution to social justice, and quite rightly so. As I have thought about that story, that conversation, a powerful realization came to me that illuminates this yin-yang story about justice. I can be having an influence on the next generation because she is there for me. She can be advocating progressive policies because I am there for her. Together, we can do the impossible. We can break the laws of physics. We can be in two places at once. But this only works if the yin-yang of self and other is brought together and made complete. The one offering social justice opportunity must minister to the one who has labored 1,000 hours to come face to face with the memory of the moment of annihilation. The one offered a social justice opportunity must minister to the one who has labored 1,000 hours to get a 10-minute meeting with an elected official, or whose heart for social justice was broken by an event like Kent State. Only then can we break the laws of physics. Only then does the magic work. This sermon started out with math and science and has ended with magic. If I have done the job I set out to do, then that yin-yang, too, is complete. The empirical and the magical have been brought together.